Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 10th of January. More than 1,500 people have been arrested in Brazil after the invasion of Congress and the presidential palace. We hear from our correspondent at one of the protest camps being cleared. Pakistan receives pledges of more than $9 billion to help it recover from last year's floods. And
if a new variant comes from China, it would be a very difficult situation for the world. It would also be a disaster for the Korean healthcare system. We currently have a lot of hospitalizations and deaths already. This is what we are worried about.
Why South Korea is taking no risks as people from China start to travel for the first time in 3 years. Also in the podcast, it's liftoff for Cosmic Girl, the first satellite-carrying rocket to head into orbit from UK soil, and a first for Western Europe. The error-strewn war memorial in Washington.
Most bizarrely, perhaps, it includes one Marine who lived happily for 60 years after the war, long enough to become a grandfather 8 times over.
And the former frontman of one of England's biggest punk rock bands of the 70s sets his sights on the Eurovision Song Contest. Many supporters of the far-right Brazilian leader Jair Bolsonaro refused to accept his defeat in the presidential election 10 weeks ago. Some camped outside the army headquarters in the capital, Brasilia, calling on the military to intervene. Last month, a group of them even tried to invade the federal police headquarters. But the warnings went unheeded, and on Sunday, thousands of Bolsonaro supporters were able to smash their way into the presidential palace, Congress and the Supreme Court, raising questions about the loyalties of the police. Now, some would argue a day late, Brazilian security forces have moved in to clear the protest camps. At least 1,500 people have been arrested. The new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has condemned what he called terrorist acts, and other Brazilians agree.
Regarding the demonstrations, I think they're unnecessary. They're an attack against democracy, an attack against the Brazilian population, and in no way is this a form of freedom of expression. This is an attack and terrorism against the country.
But Brazil remains a nation divided, and there are many who do not accept Lula's victory.
We think the Supreme Court has a hand in something that's happening, so we believe that we were robbed at the ballot boxes. That's why there are these demonstrations. And I think it's absurd that a thief president who stole from the country has returned to the crime scene to be re-elected, and he's there being president. It's absurd. It's a shame for the country.
Jair Bolsonaro himself is currently in a US hospital where he's being treated for abdominal pains, something he suffered from in the past as a result of a near-fatal knife attack during the 2018 presidential election campaign. He has denied inciting his supporters and condemned the invasion of public buildings. Earlier, I caught up with our correspondent Katie Watson in Brazil's biggest city, São Paulo.
Well, I'm actually by the camp that's being dismantled in Sao Paulo outside the military barracks here, because it's not just Brasilia that had these camps. They were across the country. Police arrived about 4 hours ago. It was relatively quiet. People were packing up begrudgingly, I have to admit. There's a lot of anger here, even though there's calm and the calm has restored to the country. I think that the political division, the anger has not gone away. There are probably 30 people who are watching on behind a police cordon, very angry with the Brazilian flag, which has become so associated with far right here in Brazil. And they're not giving up their fight. They really believe that they should be allowed to be here and are very angry about being made to move on.
And what action will we see against the rioters and indeed those who fail to stop them?
Well, I mean, they've been given 24 hours to clear out. The tricky thing is there are accusations that authorities have been siding with some of these protesters or have at least been sympathetic in their views towards them. And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge that Lula, the president, faces, because, you know, this is such a divided country. Jair Bolsonaro had the security forces, the armed forces, a lot of them were on his side when he talked so much about security and safety in this country. country. I think, you know, moving on and trying to get past and also have a post-mortem on exactly what happened and how it could have happened in Brasilia is going to be the biggest challenge. But certainly, I mean, the political division is not going anywhere. They're still very angry with what's happened. And in fact, they're even blaming the left. I spoke to several people here who said the people who infiltrated, the people who were violent in Brasilia were not from the right. They were not Bolsonaro supporters. Those were the left. And so we're carrying on with this political discourse even after what we've seen in the last 24 hours.
Katie Watson in Sao Paulo. And as we record this podcast, the US President Joe Biden has just invited the Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to visit Washington in early February. Pakistan says it's been promised billions of dollars in funding to help it deal with the aftermath of last summer's floods, which killed more than 1,700 people and left widespread destruction. The UN and the Pakistani government are hosting a joint donor conference in Geneva. Here's our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis.
Months on from the floods, and while the water has receded, it has not gone away, nor has the damage it left behind. This long-term plan from the Pakistan government is intended to rebuild and create greater resilience. In total, it's estimated it will cost more than $16 billion US dollars. Pakistan has said it will cover half the cost itself. For the rest, it's turning to the international community. Last year, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the floods climate carnage. Today, he called for a coalition of the willing to help fund Pakistan's resilience plan.
We must match the heroic response of the people of Pakistan with our own efforts and massive investments to strengthen their communities for the future. Rebuilding Pakistan in a resilient way will run in excess of $16 billion US dollars, and far more will be needed in the longer term.
The pledges have already begun to come in, both in the form of funding and projects. Pakistan's information minister announced $2 billion US dollars from the World Bank and $4.2 billion from the Islamic Development Bank, as well as significant contributions from the US, China and the EU. She said more than $8 billion had been reached within a few hours of the start of the conference. The focus now will be on what happens next and whether the country's infrastructure can be made more resilient before the rains come again.
Caroline Davis in Islamabad. The governments of Britain, France and Germany have summoned Iranian diplomats to condemn the execution of anti-government protesters in Iran. Three more people have been sentenced to death there, accused of killing members of the security forces during the demonstrations. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
Britain's Foreign Secretary James Cleverly said the execution of two anti-government protesters in Iran over the weekend was abhorrent. He summoned the country's most senior diplomat in London to the Foreign Office to be told the UK condemned the executions in the strongest possible terms. Iran's ambassadors in Berlin and Paris were also summoned. Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said the executions and Iran's continuing repression of its people would not be without consequences. Despite the international condemnation, three more people have been sentenced to death in Iran, accused of killing members of the security forces during the protests.
James Landell. People in Ghana have expressed outrage after the American rapper Meek Mill posted a music video that appears to have been filmed in the Ghanaian presidential palace, Jubilee House. Some users took to social media to complain about security issues over filming a rap video in such a high-profile building.
I gotta chill, no, I keep one in the head. About what you did, I know that killer gangsta, I'd rather buy my mom a crib.
To find out more about the row and the video, I've been talking to our correspondent Mark Wilberforce in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
What's seen in the video, Oliver, is that you have Meek Mill along with an entourage of his that are reciting lyrics to a song that he's recorded in the Jubilee House. He's also standing next to the podium that the president, Nana Akufo-Addo, would normally stand on to address the nation. So it really did ruffle the feathers of a lot of Ghanaians. There were split opinions about this. Some people thought it was great seeing a high-profile American artist such as Meek Mill expressed this adoration for Ghana, but others were equally frustrated because they thought a Ghanaian artist would almost certainly not be able to get this type of access to record a video. So why was Meek Mill granted this access?
Now, of course, he wasn't trying to offend anyone. He was actually trying to celebrate his Ghanaian heritage that he recently found out about.
Indeed, Oliver. He found out that he is 18% of Ghanaian heritage and Ivorian heritage. So he really wanted to show his love for the country that hosted him as he performed late December on a festival called Afro Nation. You know, his intention wasn't to offend at all, but it definitely was taken the wrong way.
Yeah, the fact that he was able to use his celebrity power to get access to the presidential palace has obviously upset many.
Precisely, Oliver. Even A-list artists in Ghana, such as Stoneboy or Shatawale or Miss V, these are extremely popular people, yet it's almost impossible to think that they could shoot a video in the Jubilee House.
And have we heard anything from either Meek Mill or the government following this row?
Meek Mill has since taken down the video. He's profusely apologised, and he's also saying that he's taking full responsibility for any offence caused. There hasn't been no official word from the government. However, I think in the days to come, there almost certainly will be.
Mark Wilberforce in Accra in Ghana. For the first time since 2020, visitors are now able to enter China without needing to quarantine. But the scrapping of zero COVID after 3 years has allowed the virus to spread unchecked. Indeed, an official said on Monday that 90% of people in one of the country's biggest provinces were infected. It's led other nations to impose restrictions on Chinese travellers. Some of the toughest measures have been put in place by neighbouring South Korea, as Nick Marsh reports from Seoul.
Welcome to Seoul International Airport. Unless, that is, if you're from China. Roughly a third of all Chinese arrivals here have tested positive for COVID-19 since new rules were brought in last week. Several countries around the world have been reimposing testing requirements in response to China's recent COVID surge, but South Korea's gone one further, suspending tourist visas for Chinese travellers, stopping just short of an all-out travel ban.
All arrivals from China here in Seoul are being funneled through Arrival Gate D. So right in front of me, the first batch of passengers from Shanghai are walking through the doors. The flight just landed about half an hour ago. They're being met by the army, actually, all dressed in PPE. They're just explaining to them what happens now. So after clearing a pre-departure test, they now have to do an arrival test. If that result is positive, then they're going to have to spend 7 days in a quarantine hotel.
Some have taken the law into their own hands. A Chinese man who tested positive last week went on the run. CCTV footage showed him bolting out of a white van as it pulled up outside a quarantine hotel for foreigners. 2 days later, he was caught by police and arrested. But when I was there, security at the airport did seem quite relaxed. I was even able to speak to people from the Shanghai flight just as they made their way to the testing centre.
I personally think it's okay. I have been through much worse.
This is William. He's a businessman from Shanghai.
I can understand different country has their different policy. People can decide what they want to do. As a traveller, I just try to comply with the policies as much as possible.
William was pretty relaxed about the new protocol, but the Chinese government isn't. Even though anyone arriving in China still needs to do a pre-departure test, the Chinese government have called restrictions for outbound Chinese travellers unacceptable and unscientific.
Professor Kim.
Hi, nice to meet you.
So what's South Korea's justification? Professor Kim Woo-ju is one of the country's leading COVID experts, who's advised the government on several occasions.
There's no monitoring for new variants in China at the moment, and there's no transparency. If a new variant comes from China, it would be a very difficult situation for the world. It would also be a disaster for the Korean healthcare system. We currently have a lot of hospitalizations and deaths already, and our elderly people are also under-vaccinated. This is what we are worried about.
But not all experts agree, and not everyone thinks it's a purely medical decision.
A lot of Korean people hold a lot of animosity for blaming China in general for the coronavirus.
This is Jin Sun, who I meet in departures, heading to Abu Dhabi.
they weren't able to block them when the virus first hit. And so I think now that they have a second chance, they're just like definitely don't want them to come into the country.
The new rules are expected to last at least a month to allow enough time for scientists to collect data on any possible new variants.
That report from South Korea by Nick Marsh. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Everyone wants a stable income and don't want to work on a farm. So I have to fall back on technology. With a drone, I can spray 1 acre of land in 15 minutes.
From farming to security, why India is setting its sights on becoming a global drone hub. A repurposed jumbo jet has just left Newquay Airport in Cornwall in western England on a mission to put satellites into orbit, the first space launch of its kind from British soil. The flight is being carried out by a Boeing 747 owned by the British entrepreneur Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Orbit Company. From Newquay, here's our science correspondent Jonathan Amos.
For much of the day, it had been blowing a gale across the Cornish coast. But as the sun went down, the winds abated and the jumbo they call Cosmic Girl headed down the runway. The plane has a rocket tucked under its left wing. At the appropriate moment, this space vehicle will be jettisoned to fire its own engine and begin the climb to orbit with 9 satellites. Virgin Orbit is the first company to offer such a launch service from Britain, but others are set to follow. The UK gave up the ability to launch satellites 50 years ago. Its manufacturing sector believes it'll be more competitive internationally if it gets that capability back.
Jonathan Amos. For months, Russia has been battling to take the eastern Ukrainian town of Bakhmut, pouring troops into a battle that's been compared to the worst fighting of the First World War. Western analysts say that Bakhmut has little strategic value, but it's claimed the Russians may actually be interested in what lies underneath the town and beneath neighbouring Soledar. The head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, says a huge labyrinth of caves and mines could prove very helpful for the Russian war effort. Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor at BBC Monitoring, told me more about the mines and first the latest on the fighting in Bakhmut.
It's still going on. Both sides are making claims that they are making incremental advances. But after all these months, Bakhmut is still in Ukrainian hands.
And tell us about this network of tunnels that the Russians may be interested in.
Well, there are a number of mines in the area, gypsum mines and salt mines. Now, gypsum mines first. One of the things that Bakhmut was famous for decades in the Soviet Union was champagne, because in one of those abandoned gypsum mines, there was a winery. Why the mine? It's because it was easier to control the temperature and the humidity in there, about 70 metres below surface. So the winery was set up in 1950, and towards the end of the Soviet Union, it was one of the biggest and best producers of champagne for the workers of the Soviet Union.
Champagne equivalent, because not made in France, but what they were drinking in the Soviet Union.
In the Soviet Union, that's what it was known as, Sovetskaya Shampanskaya, or Artyomovskaya Shampanskaya, Soviet champagne. So this is quite a contrast from the way we know Bakhmut now, ruined, destroyed. But back then, it was kind of a symbol of, you know, festivity. This is what you had to have on your table on a New Year's Eve, for example, champagne.
So is it loads of bottles of this fizzy wine that Prigozhin is after, or the First World War weapons that he says are stored there?
Well, there have been reports, unconfirmed, that one reason why Russia and Russian troops, including this private military company, are so obsessed with capturing Bakhmut are these mines, because apparently you can still extract enough gypsum and salt from the area to make people interested. As for the weapons, I'm not sure there's any basis for that claim. I've not seen any tanks being stored in those mines.
Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor at BBC Monitoring. India is betting big on the drone industry. It's hoping to become a global hub by 2030. Last year, it banned many imports to give its homegrown industry a boost. Our correspondent Arunadeh Mukherjee has been out to see how it's going.
In a rural part of India, in the middle of a sprawling paddy field, Ashok Kumar, whose family has been farming for generations, is using a drone to spray pesticide on his crops in the southern Indian city of Kanchipuram. It flies across the length and breadth of the farm, a job that ordinarily would have taken a few labourers to do.
It's tough to find labour. Everyone wants a stable income and don't want to work on a farm. Even my kids are not keen. So I have to fall back on technology. With a drone, I can spray 1 acre of land in 15 minutes. It takes half the amount of pesticide and there is little wastage.
Ashok pays a little over $10 for the services of a drone pilot, and the drone does the work.
Flying drones to aid farming is still at a nascent stage in India, but it is a start. For a country of India's size and diverse terrain, drones, experts feel, could be a flight in the right direction and play a major role in economic development.
वो भारत में ड्रोन सर्विस और ड्रोन आधारित इंडस्ट्री की लंबी छलांग का प्रतिबिंब है.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi has repeatedly stressed on the need to push India to become a global drone hub. The government has offered incentives worth millions of dollars to startups to encourage manufacturing and services to take the industry to nearly $4 billion in the next 3 years. The founder of Garuda, one of the biggest drone companies in India, takes me around his manufacturing and assembling unit in the southern Indian city of Chennai. Agnishwar Jayaprakash tells me that the use of drones is now expanding across industries.
So ultimately, the manner in which we capture data and the way we process it has definitely changed the game in several industries like mining, surveying, project monitoring, mapping, and also in the defense sector.
Back in the farm, as Ashok drives his tractor, ploughing other parts of his land, he says he is one of the few in his village who has dared to experiment. He says he now wants to buy a drone to lease to other farmers. The seeds are being sown, as India's push into drone technology also becomes one of the driving forces for development in the country.
That report by Arunadeh Mukherjee. Now, are you lucky enough to be taking a skiing holiday in the near future? Well, if you're heading to Europe, the good news is that snow conditions are said to be improving in the Alps, after resorts recently found themselves short of snow. So what's been going on? Craig Burton, Managing Director at Ski Solutions, has been talking to Evan Davis.
I was in the Port de Soleil, which was really the epicentre of this sort of no snow story. That's in the part of the northwestern French Alps. It's quite an interesting destination in that there's quite a lot of low-lying resorts within that region. They lie at an altitude of about 1,000 metres. But there are other resorts as part of that region. And I was staying in one called Avoriaz, which is up at 1,800 metres. And the skiing was all happening up there. It was very busy because all of the skiers from the lower resorts were coming up. But everyone was skiing.
Tell us how you would describe the situation in the Alps at the moment, because obviously it has been a rather exceptional season so far.
It's been warmer than usual and there's been some rain. For anyone who's a skier, they will know that rain is not a friend of skiers. Not all resorts have had the problem equally. We've seen big differences depending on the altitude and the latitude, indeed, of different resorts. Most of our clients travelling over New Year haven't even noticed a problem. It's those who've been lower down, though, that really have been affected.
And has there been compensating snow elsewhere? Has the snow migrated to Norway, perhaps, or somewhere else?
My reference to latitude had Norway in mind. They've had a quite exceptional start to the season. They've got very deep snowfall there, and we've seen a lot of snow as well in North America, particularly on the West Coast. Places like California, Utah, Colorado have all had exceptional snow this year.
It must be really difficult to run a business which is so weather dependent and where the weather is perhaps becoming somewhat unreliable for you and the people, the suppliers, those who are out there in the business.
Yeah, it's quite fair. I think we're all becoming used to more extreme weather. And indeed, anyone who works or has spent any time in the travel industry, particularly over COVID times, has had to show quite a lot of resilience. I mean, lest we forget, only 12 months ago, we were still unable to even travel to the French Alps. We were under a lockdown in terms of travel across the border.
But do you ever feel that maybe the long-term prognosis for your business is threatened by climate change? The glaciers seem to be melting faster than people were expecting.
I think we can't deny the longer-term climatic change that is underway. I think what we'll see is travellers, skiers looking to press into those higher latitudes. So we expect to see more skiing longer-term in places like Norway and into higher altitudes above sort of 1,700 metres. But it's not that there's no snow in the Alps. It's just concentrated into certain areas. And I think our message to consumers is that if you speak to a trusted travel agent or tour operator, those who really know, they will be able to help guide you to the resorts that have got snow and are in the best shape for skiing.
Craig Burton talking to Evan Davis. Researchers say they've uncovered a catalogue of errors on a new memorial in Washington, D.C. that was meant to include the name of every American who died fighting in the Korean War. Mark Duff reports.
Costing $22 million in gleaming black granite, the Wall of Remembrance on Washington's National Mall was unveiled last summer. It was designed to be a fitting memorial to more than 36,000 Americans who died fighting in the Korean War. But relatives and researchers have uncovered a litany of mistakes. About 500 victims are missing, and more than 1,000 names are misspelt, some of them so badly mangled that they're barely recognisable. The wall even includes 245 service members who died in circumstances totally unrelated to the fighting, including one man killed in a motorcycle accident and another who drank antifreeze, thinking it was alcohol. Most bizarrely, perhaps, it includes one Marine who lived happily for 60 years after the war, long enough to become a grandfather eight times over. The Korean War was one of the bloodiest conflicts of the 20th century. It witnessed a higher proportion of civilian deaths, even, than the Second World War or the Vietnam War. No peace treaty was ever signed when the fighting ceased in July 1953, and the two Koreas, North and South, are still technically at war.
Mark Duff. The Sex Pistols shot to fame in the 1970s with punk hits like Anarchy in the UK, all a long way removed from the Eurovision Song Contest, you might think. But the band's former frontman, Johnny Rotten, or John Lydon as he's now known, is hoping to take part in this year's event in Liverpool. He wants to represent Ireland at Eurovision with a song called Hawaii, described as a love letter to his wife of nearly five decades, who's living with Alzheimer's. Our Eurovision reporter Daniel Rosny has been having a listen.
When you think of John Lydon or Johnny Rotten, this probably doesn't come to mind. Instead, it's more than likely this. The Sex Pistols' take on the monarchy under Elizabeth II in 1977. A year later, the band split. John Lydon formed Public Image Limited, a post-punk, critically acclaimed band with a handful of hits. After a few lineup changes and a 17-year hiatus, they returned in 2009, releasing two albums and began performing live together again. Now, they're hoping to represent Ireland with this. It was about 5 years ago when the singer, whose parents were Irish, revealed his wife was living with Alzheimer's, the inspiration for this track. Remember me, I remember you. In 2021, he spoke to the BBC about being his wife's full-time carer.
I think it's one of the greatest cures of all, really, for Alzheimer's, is keep them laughing. It's a strange illness. It's like a Swiss cheese, but the holes keep getting bigger.
The decision will be made on Irish TV next month, facing competition from five other acts. Ireland has won the song contest seven times, more than any other country. And John Lydon is hoping with Hawaii, he'll say aloha to Liverpool.
Daniel Rosny. And that's almost all from us for now, but I just want to tell you about a special edition of the podcast we're doing in a couple of weeks to mark 3 years since Britain left the European Union. We'll be looking at what Brexit means for Britain's place in the world today. So if you have a question or view on that, please send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And it would be great if you could send a voice note that we can put to our UK political correspondent Rob Watson, our Europe editor Katya Adler, and our global trade correspondent Darshini David. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.